What kind of a show are you guys putting on here today?
You're not interested in art?
No.
Now look, we're going to do this thing. We're going to have a conversation.
From Chicago, this is Film Spotting. I'm Josh Larson.
And I'm Adam Kempinar. A little Film Spotting fix here, as we did want to finally close out our Luis Buñuel marathon. It's dragged out a little bit over the holidays, and we already have Agnes Varda coming up very quickly. So we're going to talk about the final film in our marathon, That Obscure Object of Desire from 1977, which also was Luis Buñuel's final film. I believe I saw this right, made it when he was 80 years old.
Yeah.
Which is pretty striking because it's a very vital, vital film. And then we will close everything out with our Luis Buñuel awards. And we really got creative here. We're calling the awards those obscure objects of desire.
Hey, when it's right there for you,
it's
you
there.
Just go with it.
So this film, this is funny, Josh. I had assumed I had never seen That Obscure Object of Desire.
Okay.
That's why, in fact, it's part of the marathon.
Right,
we
yeah.
usually, with rare exceptions, we try to find 4 to 6 movies that we both haven't seen. So this is all about discovery. And we've both seen some other Buñuel films. Well, then I started watching it, and it started to seem really familiar.
Uh-huh.
I felt like I'd seen this before. And at first I thought, well, Buñuel's movies are very similar in some ways. Similar themes and similar actors.
Right.
We get Fernando Rey in a lot of them. And I thought, okay, maybe I'm just lost in this haze of Buñuel. No, within about 15 minutes, I knew that I had seen this movie before, and it turns out I had seen it because I was specifically preparing for a top five we did in either 2011 or 2012, but you were pretty new to the show, and it was our top five doppelgangers.
Oh, sure.
And so in my research,
yeah.
this film came up because, of course, it very notably, very famously, features 2 different actresses playing the same character, Conchita, and nobody comments on it. It's just mm-hmm. never explained. It's never discussed in any way. In some cases, it's not just scene to scene. Within the same scene, one actress will go into
the
bathroom
and
then the other actress comes out. So notable for that. And it is something we've seen in plenty of films where we have one actor or actress playing multiple roles. But this might be the only example I can think of where we have different women portraying different parts, really, of one woman in some ways. And we can get into that, I guess, as we go through it. I'm curious, though, how successful you found that ploy of Buñuel's. Certainly, he's a prankster. And,
right.
And it's not surprising to see something like this come from him.
I'm glad it was in there because it did offer a little wrinkle that the movie probably needed, because it struck you as familiar, as you said, not just because you'd seen it before, but because it is in many ways similar to, say, The Discreet Charm of the Bourgeoisie or in the targets it's choosing as well. Not only the fact that there are formal similarities and the actors who are the same and the thematic concerns, but it kind of makes you sit up a little bit and notice and think about, okay, so how is this being used? I think it does fit in with his tendency not only to be a prankster, but to make you second guess what you're seeing and the symbolism behind the mm-hmm. images he's choosing, which is something he did from the very beginning with Un Chien Andalou we saw. And so I like that element of it. I would say that I had a slightly different experience, it sounds like, of the purpose of this choice of having these 2 actresses. The one is Carol Bouquet, the other is Angela Molina. I think they each have very different qualities.
Yeah.
You could say maybe Bouquet is reserved and more sophisticated, where Molina is playful and lively.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't know if that's meant to say as much about the character as this idea of what womanhood means to the Fernando Rey.
Yeah.
Character.
And maybe society as a whole.
And maybe you could extend that. But the fact that this gentleman who she's his chambermaid, who he hits on initially, she quits because of that and he just continues to pursue her. There are times where she'll seem to encourage him. She'll even offer to move in with him.
Yet another chambermaid.
There you go. When they get to the bedroom, then she pulls back again and makes him wait. And so this is going back and forth. And to me, it really was more about the idea that this could be any woman. This could be any individual for the Rey character. It's more this idea of the pursuit that he is after, this idea of desire that he just needs a body to fill that in a way.
Yes.
And the particular individual or human being who's inhabiting that body does not matter so much.
Right.
So that's how it worked for me, which I thought was interesting. And it is, you know, always interesting to see how the different actors are going to play what is ostensibly the same role.
Yeah, I'm with you. I think we see it very similarly, though, I guess, in seeing those differences in their personalities a little bit and their temperament. One, Carol Bouquet, comes across as this very sophisticated, a little bit more elegant French woman. And Conchita, played by Angela Molina, she's certainly more sensual and she's more provocative and I think, as you said, more playful. And I wonder if maybe, and this is probably reducing it and making it too simple, but there's a little bit of a Madonna whore thing going on where I think that the French version of Conchita comes off as the more refined woman that could be part of his life, and the other one is the woman he wants to have in the bedroom.
Mm.
He ultimately is attracted to both versions of this woman because, to your point, I think the real key is that he's just not interested in distinguishing any of the characteristics of this woman. He sees her purely as that titular object of desire, and he can't grasp her. And so just when he's close, even it seems, to getting what he wants, another version of her appears in the room. As we said, in one seduction scene in particular, she goes off to the bathroom. You think she's coming back. Everything's a go. Finally, he's going to get to act on his desires that she continually has been pushing him back. And instead, the other version of her comes out. And not only the other version, the actress, but she now has a completely different mood and mindset in that case. But he really does see her as that object, something he wants and can't have. Something, I think, more importantly, something he feels like he's entitled to. Something he deserves to have simply because of his stature and of his station. And again, he makes no real distinction in the qualities or the characteristics that make her a woman, that make her an individual. She simply is that object to him.
Yeah. And the other element that speaks to the myopia that this character has, that other Ray characters have had for sure in the Buñuel films we've seen, is this thread of the terrorist threats that are going on in the background where people are dying. I mean, there's real danger.
Yeah.
And for him, for the Ray character, this is just an annoyance, a nuisance.
Yeah.
You know, it's kind of getting in the way of his pursuit and his lifestyle.
Yeah, it speaks to the focus of his desire.
Yes.
That he can't be bothered with all these other things going on in the world.
Yeah, the one point where they have to, like,
right around him.
Drive around it, right.
Yeah.
It's just like a traffic jam. Yeah, that's funny too. And something that's carried in through, you know, in Discreet Charm. I think we see some of that in some of the other films too. I mean, I could watch this character, this scoundrel is the word we've used.
Mm-hmm.
Matthew is his name here that Ray plays. I could just watch him do these guys all day long.
I know.
It's so amusing. And the clownish expressions on his face when he's thwarted, when he's getting so close to what he wants, and then the rug is pulled out from under him. You know, there's a reason that he was in what, four of Buñuel's films, I think, right?
So,
yeah, and he's a joy to watch here, too.
Yeah, he is. I think that what he might be getting at there is, just with all the terror elements, is the randomness of it all. And this fits in with the fact that there are no rules about how women appear in this film. The fact that we get two completely different looking women playing one character, at any moment, this world is susceptible to a bomb going off, right? To death and destruction. And there's a certain folly, I think Buñuel is suggesting, in trying in any way to control what you do or what happens to you, or God forbid, trying to control another person in this world. And I wonder if on some level, the thing about Ray, with everything about the way he looks, the silver hair, the just sort of upper class aristocratic vibe he gives off, the suits he wears, his demeanor, it's almost like he's a throwback to a time where there was order and there was meaning and there were certain expectations in place. And now those expectations aren't met by other people. And now it's chaos happening all around him. But of course, I doubt that world ever really existed. Like, that's what makes him almost like a ghost, is he's this throwback to a time that probably only ever really existed in the heads of people like him that had that sense of entitlement. So it was sort of a mythical time and experience. They're constantly, I feel like, trying to reattain, but but again, probably never really existed at all. It's only in their heads. And so Buñuel's having a lot of fun with that desire, that elusiveness, just keeping it constantly out of their reach.
Well, and part of that is the roles people are supposed to play, right? This is another chambermaid where it's expected that along with her domestic duties is to be his plaything if he so chooses.
Yes.
And when she refuses, that's stepping outside of that role and throwing things off kilter to the way that he thinks it should be and it used to be, perhaps.
Yeah. And speaking of roles you play, that comes up in the fact that this is a story being told. This is Ray's version of the story. There is a framing device as he gets on a train, and we've just seen him throw a bucket of water in Conchita's face, and then he gets on, and the other passengers want to hear the story that are in his little cabin. So again, it's about control. Who gets to sort of frame your narrative? Who gets to possess you in that way? And I feel like he essentially does try to own her, but he's also chained to her through his passion, right, in a way that makes him unable to escape that. But the idea that we're watching this whole time, a framing device, a story that's being told as if the story has happened and there's no future for it. And then what we get a little bit of a surprise at the end. Mm-hmm. No, actually, it's still ongoing. It's part of that randomness. We feel like there's a little bit of order in that everything we're about to witness has all already happened.
Right,
but guess what? No, the story is still unfolding.
There's some funny stuff with that framing device, too, in when we cut back and forth. And at first, there is a kid in the train car when he's telling this story. And then it gets a little steamier.
Yeah, much more graphic.
What does Buñuel do like when things get really graphic and we cut back? He's brought in another kid from the home.
Yeah.
It's like, you know, you might
be
like, I hope that little kid is out of the train car for this point.
I was thinking
same
thing.
He brings in another kid.
There's two of them. And then the mom at least has the foresight to be like, well, actually, I think it's Ray that says, Ray's like, maybe the kid should leave.
Right,
and the mom's
that's pretty
maybe
good.
Not. So that obscure object of desire, I think a great ending point, obviously appropriate with Buñuel's career, it being his final film. And that brings us to our Buñuel Awards, those obscure objects of desire. We start with performances. We always start with supporting performance, could be male or female. Where did you go?
Might be a surprise here, but I went with Simone Signoret, the prostitute, Jin.
See, I thought I was going to come up with a surprise.
Did you go with
her? Yes, I went with Jin as well, from
Death
in the Garden. Yeah.
You know, this was a surprising one, Death in the Garden. This is sort of Casablanca to have and have not riff.
Yeah.
I really enjoyed it. I thought it was quite entertaining in that tradition and also the little tweaks that Buñuel gave. And it's an ensemble cast, so could have chosen anyone here for this award. Mm-hmm. They're all quite good. But Signoret as a Jin, she just I couldn't resist the Lauren Bacall vibe that she brought
to
it. And doing her own thing, too, at the same time. So
yeah, and maybe we should quickly list all the titles in the marathon. We started with his first film, Un Chien Andalou, and L'Âge d'Or, and then Robinson Crusoe, Death in the Garden, Diary of a Chambermaid, Tristana, and then the final film we just discussed. I went with Simone Signoret as well. I considered, certainly, Carol Bouquet, who made her debut as Conchita in that obscure object of desire. I wasn't surprised to learn later that she was a Bond girl. She was in For Your Eyes Only.
Huh.
And it's not just that she's hot or she's attractive. It's that she has that kind of Bond girl quality, almost like she's from another planet. There's just something, I think, in the way she looks on screen that is really mesmerizing, and I think she's very good in the role. Michel Piccoli, because he's both in Diary of a Chambermaid as the lascivious husband, but he's in Death in the Garden as Father Lizardi.
Yeah, that's right.
And Franco Nero as Horatio, the love interest in Tristana. But I went with Signoret for all the same reasons you did, thinking of her sort of doing her own riff on Bacall from To Have and Have Not, and just her combination of headstrong and helpless, I thought was great on screen. Lead performance. This is tough because, of course, you've got multiple Fernando Rey performances to choose from, but then you also have Catherine Deneuve as Tristana. You have Jean Moreau as Celestine in Diary of a Chambermaid. How do you choose?
You know what you do? You cheat. And you go with...
I thought about this.
You go with Deneuve and Rey.
Leave it to you to
in
cheat.
In Tristana.
Oh.
Right?
No.
You have to. You can't separate them. The film depends so much on both of them. It's one of those where it's like they're giving one performance.
Okay, well.
And that's just how I saw that.
Okay, so, well, if you're going to cheat, I'm going to cheat too, because I had him as 1A and 1B. I did.
You can lump them together. That's
I did
fine.
Have as my 1A Fernando Rey.
Okay.
I just feel like we needed to give him that recognition from this marathon. But whether you've seen him in That Obscure Object or The Discreet Charm of the Bourgeoisie, not part of this marathon, or Vera Diana, not part of this marathon, and then, of course, the last film we talked about, he does always play that scoundrel character. He's on that spectrum anyway, and he's also a character who's always being stifled from getting what he wants. And I do think that Don Lope shows him at his most repressed and at times his most diabolical, but also his most sympathetic. I think that's the key difference. And don't get me wrong, he's being constantly repressed in That Obscure Object of Desire, but I feel like it's almost worse that he gets a taste of what he wants from Catherine Deneuve, and then she continually foils him and won't be the woman to him that he wants. And so I feel like he actually gives a darker performance in Tristana versus Obscure Object.
It's darker. I think it's grander in some ways, too, while still being like just the way he's increasingly and comically foiled. You know, that's the heart of his performances, and you have that there, too. And then Deneuve in that picture, you know, in Tristana, the way she becomes this haunting specter by the end really did elevate that movie for me. So I think of it very differently in where it brings us at the end from the things that are going on at the beginning. And both of those performances are crucial to that. So, yeah, I couldn't separate them.
Okay. The most Buñuelian moment, and shock me here, Josh. Tell me that you picked something other than the razor blade across the eye from Un Chien and Ilu.
Okay, I didn't pick it for
really?
Here.
Really? Because
no.
I did.
Okay, well, good.
I picked it for Buñuelian moment.
Okay, and
but
I could
I could reverse them.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, I could switch
them. I
had
the same thing. But for here, for Buñuelian moment, because it was jarring in that it stood out from the rest of the film, I'm sticking with Tristana, I'm sticking with Don Lope, and it's his head as the clapper to the bell. That was
that
like
nightmare
such,
vision.
Yeah, a nightmare that I think is twice in the film we see it, at least twice. You know, this is – Tristana is otherwise pretty straightforward. I think you could say it's free of such flourishes. But this recurring dream image that she has of her guardian's decapitated head ringing the bell, it just – it captures that – I think it was the unsettling surrealism in this idea of juxtaposition we talked about, so that – here are two familiar elements and just putting them together in this oddly new and here like really horrific way.
Yeah. Well, that juxtaposition is what made me choose the razor blade, which is probably his signature moment.
Sure.
And could be, of course, then the ultimate best moment or scene from this marathon. But it's essentially, as we discussed when we reviewed Un Chien et Ilu, primally cinematic. And it's not just the razor blade across the eye. If it was just that, of course, that would be shocking. It's hard to watch. There's an element of surrealism. But it's the fact that he starts the movement of the razor right to left and then cuts to the moon, and the clouds are passing by in the same direction. So we get that same motion. We get that same sort of matching of action. And for me, what makes Buñuel so intriguing as a director watching this final film, I was thinking very much about how he, I think, is a mirror that reflects back to us our basest desires and instincts. But there's always an element of these characters striving for something more saintly, if you will, more sophisticated, something above themselves that they're reaching for, and they're constantly being prevented from it. And I think in that razor blade scene, in that matching of cut, we see the horror and the beauty in one moment. And again, as I said when we talked about it, the earthly and the heavenly, which are elements he's constantly putting up against each other, and they're quarreling with each other.
Yeah, you absolutely nailed it. That's why the slicing of the eyeball in Un Chien et Ilu, that's my favorite scene, favorite moment from the marathon. It's, I think it, to me, it reveals how Buñuel's imagery, it can be, it feels so impulsive and instantaneous and just like it bursts out of a subconscious. But when you break it down, as you did, and notice what he's doing with the insert shot from the clouds, you realize how carefully crafted and staged in a good way it is. So that's why I went with it for my favorite scene or moment.
Yeah, for me, I certainly could have made that the best moment or scene. But the fact is, my favorite moment in any of the films we saw was from L'Âge d'Or. And I talked about it during that review. It's the one where we go pretty randomly. The movie is bizarre and there's really not much of a narrative, but we go from a party scene to a castle somewhere. Mm. And there's all these titles telling us that there's this orgy that's gone on inside this castle. All these women, some inexperienced and some who are really skilled. And Buñuel never shows us that. He sort of lets us imagine what would be going on behind those closed doors. And then the door opens and a man emerges. And who is it? Well, it's the closest thing to Jesus I've ever seen. And the fact that he would shock us that way, not surprising, as we've now seen more of his films, but that character, it's a great cosmic joke, and it's a great bit of blasphemy. I'm sure the church saw it at the time, as they saw many of his films, to be blasphemous. Some of them didn't play for decades in his home country because of that, but that cracked me up, honestly, and it's my favorite.
Yeah, and then it goes right after that to the scalps on the cross, right?
Yeah.
So
another
that
great image.
Is a pretty provocative way to end your film.
Yes. So we end with our favorite picture from the marathon. Where'd you go?
I went with Un Chien Andalou just because somehow I had never seen it before.
Yeah.
This is what marathons are for, is to make up for those omissions. And sometimes the movies live up to their reputation. Sometimes they don't. This is one of those masterpieces that did, that surpassed it. Has to do a lot with what we talked about in that shot of the eyeball, the way that it was way more than the shock art I had assumed.
Yeah.
It would be, having just heard about it, and even just, you know, seen in passing, the 2 seconds that you see, but seeing it in context of the film overall made me appreciate the entire short. And it's just this really deep dive into somebody's subconscious, and, you know, which movies try to do a lot,
mm-hmm.
but I haven't seen any do it quite this way.
Yeah. It's a great choice. For me, I think edging it out, though, is actually That Obscure Object of Desire. My
oh, really?
Favorite one. Yeah. Just in terms of being a culmination of all of those themes, mm-hmm. all of those motifs, all of those jokes, all of those satirical jabs, I felt like it encapsulated all of that the best. And it was the most fun I had with any of the films in the marathon.
Yeah, well, that's important, you know? I mean, something that can be lost, I think, in some of the dissection mm-hmm. of these movies, and what does this reference mean, and what is this symbol alluding to, is the fact that they're very funny.
Yeah.
And not just in a, like, jab at a target way, but in things like Ray's performances mm-hmm. that we've talked about. And so, yeah, comedies in a lot of way, first and foremost.
Yeah. Well, that does it for the Luis Buñuel Marathon. We do have another one coming up. This one, like Buñuel, sponsored by our friends at Mubi. You can learn more at Mubi.com/filmspotting. Learn about all of their offerings. Learn about how you can get a new film to watch every day from them. You can also download them to your mobile device to watch offline. And a couple of the films that we're going to see as part of this Varda Marathon are available via Mubi and some other outlets as well. I will list those titles quickly here. And what I do love about this marathon and how it's laid out so far, Varda, still alive at 88, still making films. Her last real feature, I think, was 2008's The Beaches of Agnes, that documentary. But we go back all the way to La Pointe Court in 1956. We have one film covering each decade for 6 decades.
Nice.
Here. And we are getting 4 titles, at least, that I think are essential Varda, or 3 maybe anyway, that seem to be essential Varda. So we're starting with La Pointe Court in 56, The Creatures in 66, One Sings and the Other Doesn't from 1977, Vagabond, one of the big movies that I've always regretted not seeing from 1985, The Gleaners and I from 2000, and The Beaches of Agnes from 2008. So I guess we skipped the 90s and jumped ahead to 2000, but in talking to various people who are very familiar with her work, this seemed like it was a good mix of her stuff, covering the span of her career.
And my only familiarity is Cleo from 5 to 7.
Which I adore.
Is fantastic.
Yes.
So really
yeah.
excited for
Maybe
this marathon.
Get ready for the marathon by watching Cleo from 5 to 7, one of her very early works. So look forward to the Varda Marathon. We'll definitely do something next time getting away from a specific filmmaker. We'll try to do a region, perhaps, again, like the Iranian Marathon or the Scandinavian Cinema Marathon, so we can try to cast a wider net than focusing on one filmmaker. And we will take your suggestions at any time. feedback@filmspotting.net. We hope you enjoy the coming episode of Film Spotting, where we celebrate 12 years of the show and talk about the Pantheon and have some fun with Film Spotting Madness. For Film Spotting, I'm Adam Kempinar.
I'm Josh Larson. Thanks for listening.
This conversation can serve no purpose anymore. Goodbye.
Film Spotting is listener supported. Join the Film Spotting family at filmspottingfamily.com and get access to ad-free episodes, monthly bonus shows, our weekly newsletter, and for the first time, all in one place, the entire Film Spotting archive going back to 2005. That's at filmspottingfamily.com.